This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Today we're honored to have the Marfield winner for Writing in the Arts from the DC Arts Club, Keira Thurman. She's the 16th Marfield winner, and this is a very competitive judging. It is the Pulitzer Prize of Writing in the Arts. Keira, what's the title of this book?
Thank you so much for having me. The title of my book is Singing Like Germans, Black Musicians in the Land of Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms.
Why do you think it was chosen?
The title?
No, the book.
Oh, the book.
Have you ever thought, I wonder why the judges chose this?
I do. I still wonder why the judges chose
it. Why might that be?
Because I think when you're writing, you have no idea how anything's going to be received. You have no idea, you know, how your book is going to take flight once you launch it, you know, and into the world. So I've just been so amazed and flattered and truly honored by the attention that it's received so far.
It's a groundbreaking book.
Thank you.
And I was wondering if when you were little, you said, I think I'll write an award-winning book. No?
That was not on my mind. I think writing a book at all was not on my mind when I was young. I loved to play piano. I loved to, hang out with my friends and do things like that. And only over time did I really get into writing seriously.
We should let people know you are a classical pianist.
Yes.
An assistant professor at the University of Michigan.
Yes.
And you write for The New Yorker, The New York Times, right. Point Magazine, mm-hmm. and the Black Diaspora is one of your subjects.
Yes.
So this is all in this book. And I would like to start by the idea that exceptional Black musicians in the 19th century, mm-hmm. way back then, had associations with German teachers, which is very unusual, and that's the way they got to network to Germany. How did all that happen?
Sure. So my book traces this history of Black musicians going over to Europe in the 19th and 20th centuries, mostly from the United States. I originally tried to look for musicians from everywhere, but as you're pointing out, they came from the United States. They were predominantly African American for a reason. But this was starting in the late 19th century. We started seeing generations of classically trained musicians, classically trained African Americans, who came to Germany in part inspired by and with the encouragement of their music teachers, many of whom, as you're pointing out, were themselves German immigrant musicians who were oftentimes willing to work with these musicians at a time when a lot of white Americans wouldn't. So that's sort of the start of this relationship. I traced countless names of Black classical musicians who had studied with German teachers. For example, Scott Joplin, the pianist and composer of Ragtime, the entertainer, the Maple Leaf Rag, things like that. He was trained by a German Jewish teacher in Texas who he adored. And we know that for a fact because towards the end of this teacher's life, his name was Julius Weiss, about the last 10 years of his life, Scott Joplin financially supported him through his retirement. So this was clearly a sign of an intimate, loving relationship.
So we have these Black musicians, African-American musicians, going to Germany mm-hmm. from the 19th century and early 20th century. Then how do they overcome the idea that German music was white music? How do they overcome that aesthetic?
You mean the African-American musicians?
The German audiences. An aesthetic that this was white music.
Yeah.
And so here we are with Black performers having to prove this ability.
Right. I guess I would say, first of all, that for most of the German and Austrian audiences, I don't think that they originally thought that this was something like white music. It was more that the assumption was so embedded that when Black performers began to play a Beethoven sonata or sing a Wagner opera, that then, and only then, really, was the audience forced to confront what they thought this music was and to whom it belonged. So, in other words, you know, there was a general assumption that this music was German and that that somehow meant it was only white. But it was not as if this was a conscious way of thinking. It was more that when Black musicians began to perform, it challenged them to rethink exactly what this music was and for who, and again, for whom it belonged.
Well, the celebrities that were there became honored and loved, but what did they have to overcome? What were the rewards of being celebrities in Germany, and then what were the downsides of that?
Right. So, great question. So, there were so many rewards, and this is why we see so many African-American musicians going over to Germany and Austria in the 19th and 20th centuries. You know, that for so many Americans in the United States, German music, the music of Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, these different composers, was sort of considered the best music, right? And that everybody wanted to learn it, and that everybody wanted to be excellent at it. And so for these, for so many different musicians, regardless if they were black or white or whatever, you know, the joke was by the late 19th century that there were two types of music, German music and bad music. So in other words, it was really, you know, in everybody's best interest to study and learn German music. So with that in mind, for these different musicians, in my book, different African-American classical musicians, you know, part of the impetus for going to Germany and Austria was not only to get training and not only to perform, but to get and to win over perhaps these audiences that were considered the most sophisticated, the most elite, and the best arbiters of taste, and that if they could have the ringing endorsements of German audiences when they came back to the United States, that might open doors for them that had previously been closed.
But the scrutiny.
I'm sorry?
The scrutiny,
yes.
That was hard.
Yes.
They had to be perfect.
They did.
And they were perfect.
They were flawless, yes.
They had to learn German poetry.
Yes.
They had to learn German history.
Yes.
They had to translate themselves from German.
Yes.
Will you read us a piece of this prize-winning book?
Oh, sure. So how about I can read the beginning. I can just go straight from the introduction. I'll read a little bit of that.
Keira Thurman is here. She is going to read from Singing Like Germans.
Sure. Grace Bunbury glittered in gold. The African-American soprano glided around the set of the Bayreuth Festival Theater, shimmering under a dim glow of light filtered through lace netting that flooded the stage in gentle waves. Playing the role of Venus in the 19th century German composer Richard Wagner's 1845 opera Tannhäuser, Bunbury sparkled with each turn, embodying the tempting seductress she had been cast to perform, singing of love and lust to an enraptured audience of nearly 2,000 listeners, including international dignitaries, high-ranking classical musicians, music critics, and socialites. Built between 1872 and 1876, the Bayreuth Festival Theater, where Bunbury sang, was a national monument of sorts, a shrine to the works of Wagner, and every summer pilgrims flocked to the small Bavarian town to hear Wagner's opera performed in the house he had built. But in the summer of 1961, news that Wagner's grandson, Wieland Wagner, had hired a young black soprano to sing inside Bayreuth's hallowed halls sent shockwaves across West Germany. Prior to her performance that warm July evening, hundreds of letters of protest had bombarded the opera house, declaring that Bunbury's presence in Bayreuth would have that most German of composers rolling over in his grave. Bunbury ignored them all, and on the first night of her appearance, the aspiring diva received a 30-minute standing ovation. Her performance earned her international accolades and vaulted her to stardom.
This is a real action-adventure story. It is scholarship, and you know, scholarship can be fascinating, and you've proved it.
Oh, thank
because
you.
It's a page-turner.
Oh, thank
we
you.
We have personalities, what they have to overcome,
yeah.
What they want, what they have to do to get it.
Yeah.
So it is really a human story, and you bring forth all of the names, some of which we have never heard before, like Roland Hayes. Now, I was interested in hearing you say once that you thought you were writing a book of history, and then you found out you were writing a book about listening.
Yes, that for me as a cultural historian, I guess I should say as a German historian and as a musicologist, I thought I was going to be writing a fairly traditional cultural history and reception history, so to speak. And to a certain extent, I did that. But what I found over time is that I was writing not only about these performances, right, of Roland Hayes and Marian Anderson, Leontine Price and Jesse Norman and other singers, I was also writing a history of listening. I was writing a history showing the politics of listening, I think. And that became a really fascinating window for me to think about how conversations about race and music get played out on international stages is through acts of listening. And that I'm not alone in this, I should say, that there's a body of scholarship that's been arguing lately that listening is never a neutral experience, that we're always constantly bringing our own experiences to whatever we listen to, and that they're informing how we listen, that we expect certain sounds to come out of certain people, right? And so we had these cultural assumptions often embedded in our practices of listening. And I saw that play out the more research I started to do on how Germans were understanding these performances.
So they would have a wonderful Black singer presenting Schubert, say. And they would look at this person and say, wait a minute, this cannot happen, first of all. And now they attribute attitudes to that singer that may not really be there.
Yes.
And they say, the voice is this way, or the voice is melancholy. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the assumptions that they had to overcome.
Yes, yes. So again, these musicians had trained for years, right, if not decades, on their artistry, on their musicianship. They had immersed themselves in learning and memorizing German poetry and translating them line by line. And so when they got to the stage, they were more than ready. They, you know, had really, truly put so much of their brilliance and talent towards learning German music. But then, as you're pointing out, audiences then were shocked by this. They would say that if they closed their eyes and listened with their ears, they couldn't tell that the musician before them wasn't German. And that was the thing that was scary to some audiences. And so the way that they made sense of it, which you're pointing out, and you're absolutely right about this, is that they would then find excuses, in short, to make sense of what they heard. You know, so one of the ways that they would do that is they would, some critics insisted, and some listeners and musicians insisted that the performance had somehow sounded Black, even though what the musician was singing was a Schubert piece or a piece by Bach or a Mozart aria. So they would say, oh, well, her voice is smoky, it's dark, it's purple, it's Black and brown like her African skin color. One critic said that about Marian Anderson, for example. They would also say that the voice sounded guttural, as if Black voices were somehow more anthropoidal or primal or something like that. So they would find different ways to try to explain away what it was that they were hearing.
But yet, beauty does overcome, doesn't it? And I think there was much that they championed. I think some of the Black musicians that went there, African-American musicians, really were honored and loved and beloved and proved their mettle. Yeah. And I'm thinking of Marian Anderson. She was treated like royalty, wasn't she?
Yes. So she, I think, is a really great example of one of the first, what we could consider a Black celebrity in classical music. Her and Roland Hayes, who was her predecessor or a little bit ahead of her, you know, and that they absolutely had champions. They had patrons. They had these networks in Europe that rallied around them, that supported them, even with the rise of the Nazis. And in part because of the rise of the Nazis, for some of them, really insisting that singers like Marian Anderson belonged on international stages in the face of Nazism and racism.
But the influx was mostly between World War I and World War II, would you say?
For Black musicians going, or?
For the most predominant effect. Now, we know that after World War II, we had, as you say, so many African Americans there from the State Department, for example, that you can even name them.
Yeah.
But what you call the interwar, that was a very interesting time in Germany for these singers.
It was a really interesting time for these singers and for just performers in general. So like pianists and instrumentalists, too. I should also make sure to include them in this. That the interwar era was this era of freedom and liberation, and really it felt like for so many of these Black classical musicians that anything was possible. But at the same time, it's also this really turbulent era of change, of political change, with, again, the rise of Nazism, of far-right activity. Anti-Semitism is on the rise. And so it's this weird concoction and mix of feeling like these doors were finally opening to Black musicians in a way that had never been opened before, while at the same time there's a growing backlash to this new cosmopolitan world.
Talk about the jazz musicians. I think they were treated differently.
They were. They were treated differently, and their lives were different. I think this is something that my book also hopefully makes clear, which is that the social worlds of Black classical musicians were so different from those of jazz musicians that it meant that, you're right, their lives functioned differently. Jazz musicians were wildly popular in the 1920s and 30s. Figures like Josephine Baker, of course, were these scandalous figures, but also very loved and popular. She gave sold-out shows wherever she went. But for other kinds of musicians, like, for example, Josephine Harold Love, who was a classical pianist whose father, William Kemper Harold, taught at Morehouse College, which is a historically Black college and university, HBCU. You know, she lived a very different life than what we think of for, Black musicians at the time. So, in short, the reasons why their lives are so different and why their social worlds were so different is because classical music encourages a different kind of social norm and life, right? It has hours of dedicated practice and study. You're supposed to study and apprentice with a specific teacher, right? Everything in the world revolves around that teacher, I guess I would also say. You know, you have orchestra rehearsals or opera rehearsals. It's its own sort of insular world in some ways. And so, and a world that Black classical musicians wanted to join. So it meant that they didn't really rub elbows or rub shoulders very much with other Black jazz musicians because they were in very different spaces, social spaces, concert spaces, all of it.
The jazz musicians were brought, though, their own culture, which was very different. And then it fortified stereotypes also somewhat. But their world was a different world from the celebrities that were classicists. And there was like royalty and then bohemia in Europe. Yeah. But I would like to ask, since a singer would stand before an audience and actually, luckily, they were gorgeous. Roland Hayes, Marian Anderson, there was nothing to complain about, right? In the clothing and the decorum. But people were watching them and attributing different attitudes and then finding out, I was wrong. But then the instrumentalists, did they suffer the same scrutiny where people say, oh, you're attributing a plantation sound to your music? Did they do that to the instrumentalists?
Yes, I mean, I think this is also perhaps surprising for people, which is that, I mean, we've been talking a lot about vocalists and, singers, opera singers and the like, but instrumentalists, there were also Black instrumentalists, and they also faced a similar kind of practice of exoticism, right, and racializing their sound. And it's really fascinating to think about how that works. So the best example I can give is a brilliant pianist named Hazel Harrison, who was African-American from Indiana, and she performed with the Berlin Philharmonic in 1904, which just constantly blows my mind. Yes, so she performed with the Berlin Philharmonic in 1904. She performed two piano concerti, a Chopin piano concerto, Grieg piano concerto, and the critics lost their minds over this performance. And the reviews that I found were constantly trying to make sense of how she had been able to do that, as if she, shouldn't have been able to do that. And so it manifested in a couple of different ways. One, because of her gender, they assumed that this was a very difficult concert program. How could she have the stamina as a young woman to perform a rigorous piano concerto that, only men can do that kind of thing? So that was one way that she faced discrimination. But then, as you're alluding to, the other way that she faced discrimination was in their attribution of her talent. So basically, critics decided two different things. One, that the performance made sense and she played so well because African Americans, one critic said, are a melancholy people. And so Chopin's music is melancholic. So who better to perform the melancholic music of Chopin than an African American, right? So there's a way that they're trying to explain away her ability and her talent. So that's one way that we see it manifest. And then the other way that we see them trying to explain away her talent and technique and training is by saying that she appeared to be mixed race, is what one critic says. And so this is a quote verbatim, I promise. I'm not the one making this up, but a critic said, okay, so because she appears to be mixed race, quote, it must be the Caucasian blood that is doing the work in her veins, for she is not a full-blooded Negress.
Well, that explains that.
Yeah. Right, obviously it must be the Caucasian blood. So there's a way that they're trying to find excuses, or trying to find a way to make sense of what they think is impossible, that you can be African-American or a Black person performing classical music so well.
But excellence triumphs, yeah. Excellence triumphs. Mm-hmm. But we could hark way back, and you point out that in Beethoven's circle,
yeah.
There was a Black violinist.
Yes,
right?
There was. George Bridgetower is his name. He was an Afro-European violinist, and he was the son of what we think is an Afro-Caribbean servant at the Esterhazy Palace, and a woman from Central Europe. And he was a brilliant violinist. He befriended Beethoven in the early 19th century, and then Beethoven even dedicated a violin sonata to him. It was called the Sonata Mulattica, and it was originally called that, but then in a very Beethoven tradition, Beethoven and Bridgetower got into a fight over a girl, and so Beethoven changed the dedication of the violin sonata to the Kreutzer sonata. And when he gave the piece to Rudolf Kreutzer, who was supposed to perform it, Kreutzer was angry with him. He said, this piece is almost impossible to play. It was too difficult for him. But it hadn't been too difficult for George Bridgetower.
Flashing forward, mm-hmm. Josephine Baker divided opinion. Was she a great artist?
Yes. I mean, that I think goes without question. And she was also a really successful PR woman, you know, that she, I actually teach this material all the time, you know, that she had found a way to toy and play with white Europeans' expectations of her, and stereotypes of her. And she kind of cheekily threw them back in their faces and frankly laughed all the way to the bank. You know, figures like Josephine Baker and another Black woman entertainer named Ruth Beaton were earning about $200,000 a year in the 1920s. So she was a very clever
Was she classically trained?
Josephine Baker, no.
Oh,
no.
But she was skilled.
I'm sorry?
She was skilled.
Yeah, of course.
She's a great musician.
Yeah.
And another name that I think Americans might know is Paul Robeson.
Yes.
Now, we know that he went to East Germany.
Yes.
And became quite beloved there, mm-hmm. and found what he could not find here. Mm-hmm. But tell us about his time there. I mean, he was almost a saint.
Yes.
In
right.
East Germany.
Right, right, right.
But give us the time in history, which you're a historian, yeah. You're a German scholar, you're mm-hmm. a musicologist, you're a pianist. Give it to us.
Sure. You know, I think it's always surprising to people to hear that we had African-American musicians going over to communist East Germany, and that they're going for the same reasons as they were going to West Germany and Austria and Europe. They're looking for places where they can perform, and that for some of them, they also were committed Black Marxists, like Paul Robeson and a baritone named Aubrey Pankey. You know, so they're hoping that life is going to be better for them in, you know, behind the Iron Curtain, so to speak, where they'll have more freedom, more possibilities to perform. So absolutely, Paul Robeson came over in October 1960 to communist East Berlin. He was celebrated, given a peace medal, an honorary doctorate at the University of Berlin. You know, he didn't stay for long, but, you know, by all accounts, they absolutely rolled out the red carpet for him for his stay, and that he could use that as, you know, ammunition, so to speak, against the United States, and saying, look, other places are welcoming to me, and they're welcoming to the plight and struggle of Black people in the United States in a way that Americans aren't. But at the same time, there were other musicians like Aubrey Pankey, who I mentioned, who was a baritone and also a Black Marxist. He pled asylum to communist East Germany in, I think, 1954 or 1955, and lived there until his death in 1971. And he had a very different experience, though, that on the one hand, yes, he was pleased to be living in communist East Berlin, but he constantly faced racism and discrimination. And he was very vocal about that at the same time. So stories like Aubrey Pankey's, I think, complicates this narrative that communist East Germany was going to be this promised land for Black musicians. Yeah.
And there was racism, and there was anti-Semitism. There was
exactly.
There not?
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's really so embedded with history. And then when you get to Nazi Germany and how the musicians were, one actually went to a concentration camp.
Yes, several did.
And they were in fear of their lives,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And
did.
At one point, I enjoyed so much your comment that there were about, at one time in Germany and Austria, there were about 1,000 Black citizens. Black people living there, and yet the Germans were afraid of being replaced.
Yes.
They were afraid of replacement theory, and there were about 1,000 African Americans
right.
living
right.
in Germany and Austria,
yeah. Yeah.
and the Germans were afraid their race yeah. was going to be,
yeah.
well, that is very, I think that's very relative and very pertinent. Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to write this book? What was the moment that you said, all this stuff is in me, what ignited the moment you said, I've got to just start and spend the next 10 years doing this? What ignited that?
Well, if I'd known it was going to take 10 years, I might not have done it, to be completely honest. Yeah, but I did it anyway. You're right. I think a couple different things clicked for me. I was looking for a way to write about classical music in Germany because that's my passion, and that was my experience. But then at the same time, I was also trying to find a way to wrestle with the problems of anti-Black racism, both in classical music and also in German history, to be honest. That in, for me as a German historian, we've developed really great and powerful conversations on anti-Semitism in German history that have been necessary and urgent. And I think I wanted to find a way to also include conversations on anti-Black racism in German history. And so when I put these two things together, thinking about, okay, classical music and race and Blackness, you know, it's what led me down this rabbit hole to start searching for different Black classical musicians. And I should say, at the beginning, I wasn't sure what I would find. And then it quickly became apparent to me that there were dozens and dozens and later hundreds and hundreds of stories. People still email me all the time and say, you know, what about this person who had lived in Leipzig in 1875? What about, you know, I had a cousin who lived in West Germany in the 1970s and sang at the small opera house. There are all of these stories of Black Americans traveling to Europe looking for freedom and opportunities to perform.
How is it that you were raised in Austria?
Oh, that's a long story that I could go on about for a long time.
But did you perform there?
I studied,
you studied
piano.
There.
I mean, I was so I lived in my family. Oh, okay. So here's the, I'm kind of gonna try to figure out how to make this short. My grandfather moved everybody over, my dad's family, in 1970, around 1970. He was a nuclear chemist. He worked for the International Atomic Energy Association, the IAEA, which is part of the United Nations. So my dad went to the same school that I did, the same like American International School, which is really wild. He came back to the States where he met my mother, which is also complicated because she's British, Jamaican, Canadian, and is not actually American at all. And then they got married, had my sister and me, and moved everybody over to Vienna when I was a month old. So I grew up around the corner from my grandparents in Vienna, you know, and I still have family in German-speaking Europe. I have my sister and my nieces and things like that. So that's sort of the shortest version, I think, of that story I can tell.
Do you still perform?
I do.
And when can we see you perform?
Oh, well, so at this point, I do what people call Hausmusik or house music, meaning that I play with a friend of mine who's a violinist. We get together and perform Mozart violin sonatas or Dvorak or Samuel Coleridge Taylor, who was a Black British composer, or Amy Beach, who was a woman composer in the United States. And we do it mostly for ourselves, and then once in a while, we'll put on a concert in my house and invite some friends over to hear us.
We are talking to the Marfield winner, the 16th Marfield winner for writing in the arts, and it has to compete against writing in every genre, dance, film, every kind of factor of the arts, and you are the winner. Keira Thurman is the winner this year. We're honoring her. And could we end by hearing some more from your book?
Sure. So I have one other excerpt I'm going to read out loud, and I'm going to turn to it right now. And the excerpt I'm reading, I think, is hopefully helpful to everybody for thinking about African-American motivations for going to Europe. And this little excerpt is from my introduction. It's called Beethoven Goes Global, Musical Universalism and Black Migration. So that's the section I'm reading from. When asked by an American journalist in 1897 if there was a difference in her reception between American and European audiences, Cicciaretta Jones responded, yes, a marked difference. In Europe, there is no prejudice against my race. It matters not to them in what garb an artist come, so he be an artist. It is the artist's soul that they look at there, not the color of his skin. About a decade later, the African-American violinist and recent transplant to Europe, Clarence Cameron White, made the same argument in an interview with the African-American newspaper, The New York Age. Quote, on every side you find that the European musician, and music lover as well, realizes that music is too broad and too universal to be circumscribed by the complexion of the skin or texture of the hair. Both performers turn to powerful notions of classical music's universality and to myths of European colorblindness to explain why they believed Black classical musicians were better received in Europe than in the United States. Their reasons for doing so were not rooted entirely in praise of European culture. Throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, Black classical musicians expressed their righteous anger and frustration with the American classical music market, which used extreme measures to exclude them. While many had trained at conservatories of music such as Oberlin College or the New England Conservatory of Music since the late 19th century, once they stepped off the podium and graduation, they encountered constant institutional barriers to their success. Although Americans now laud Marian Anderson for breaking the racial barrier at the Metropolitan Opera House in 1954, countless Black musicians had been available to sing prior to her debut. And where were they to perform? Take, for instance, an incident in 1925 when the Italian opera singer Eduardo Ferrari Fontana staged a competition at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City to find a Black woman to sing Verdi's Aida, an opera about an Ethiopian princess who must choose between the Egyptian general Rhadamus, her father's enemy, and her loyalty to Ethiopia. The tenor Ferrari Fontana confessed, quote, it has always been a mystery to me why impresarios have not sought a Negro voice for an opera like Aida. Much to the shock and later horror of the Metropolitan Opera House, over 250 women responded to Ferrari Fontana's request for Black singers, all stating that they were ready to sing the part. And many of them were. Classically trained singers such as Muriel Rahn, who in 1959 became the first Black musical director of what is now the Frankfurt Opera, and Florence Cole Talbert, the first Black woman to perform Verdi's Aida in Europe, they were both on the short list. Yet despite the overwhelming proliferation of letters and telegrams seeking an audition, the Metropolitan Opera House shut down this vocal experiment. Spurned by classical music institutions in the United States, by the late 19th century, African-American musicians began to argue that Europe was a place of racial acceptance for their musical gifts. Black praise of Europe, however, frequently had less to do with European racial attitudes than with African-American dissatisfaction with life in the United States. Nonetheless, Black musicians claimed that while classical music in the United States operated along rigid racial fault lines, in Europe, classical music was simply too universal to be debased by racism. European support for the performances, they said, was proof that musical universalism was transcendent.
Singing like Germans, Black musicians in the land of Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms, the voice of Keira Thurman. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, by Avide Shoshani, by Sandy Jackson Cohen, and the Anne Arundel Council for the Arts. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Mike Turpin is our engineer.